Now we'll talk about mental illness and what it's like to live with mental illness. Once a month, we get this story from our guides at the People of Southern Oregon Compass House in Medford. It's built on the clubhouse model of community mental health care. It's a place where people with persistent mental illness come together to support each other and their shared place. This month, we feature the story of Michael. We'll stay on a first-name basis. He spent some time at Compass House this month talking about his experience with mental illness to Galen Thoreau, Compass House's outreach coordinator.
I always felt like I was different, like I had some sort of problem that I didn't recognize. My mom used to put me in the therapy a lot, and I didn't understand why I was there.
How young were you, do you think?
I think I was about eight or nine when I first started going to therapy.
Could you describe to us maybe some of the events leading to your being diagnosed? What did that look like for you?
Scared, angry, confused a lot. I had my ups and downs. I went through a phase where I actually dissociated for a period of time. It was a rough 6 months.
Mm-hmm. How did your family or friends react to that when you were dissociating?
I was unrecognizable.
Yeah.
They didn't know. They knew it was me, but it was not something that they were ready for, I guess, because it was less than 10 years ago, and I had this panic attack that caused me to dissociate, and I proceeded to lock myself in a room in my head, and I locked it from the inside, and before I locked myself in my head, I went down this, it was like I went down a hallway and opened up all these doors and of all these emotions, and then I went to the very back of the hallway and closed myself in and locked it up, and I was just viewing through the peephole. I can see everything, but I wasn't willing to speak. And so my dissociation caused me to be a child, a blind man at one point, a woman at one point. There was a lot of variations there. I don't think anybody was ready for it. I was certainly most not ready for it. The first one that came out was this 5-year-old kid who my mom knew as my invisible friend. His name was Charlie, and he was the first one to come out. Mm-hmm. He was my scared little boy.
Do you feel like that personality, so to speak, was helped you with coping through that time?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so, because I was scared of everything that was going on. I lived a malicious childhood. Did things, said things, and I regret every moment. And there just came a point in my life where everything changed, and I didn't want to look back. And so I just moved forward, and then something happened, and it caused me to have a severe reaction to it, and I dissociated from it, and I didn't want to see it for what it was, and I was scared because something almost occurred and never happened.
So you went into almost a protective state of mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was married at the time, and my wife came home to a 5-year-old man rocking back and forth on the carpet, just crying and tears, scared. Michael's not here right now. And then my wife freaks out. Honey, you're scaring me. Mm-hmm. Michael's not here right now. He's scared, and he fears that you're going to hate him. And that was my life-changing moment.
So what did it look like when you were initially diagnosed? Was it during one of these episodes?
Yes and no. for a period of 6 months, I went in and out. Like, I would react to a certain thing, my whole body would just give out, and I would drop to the floor like I fainted. Mm-hmm. And then I would become somebody different.
So how were you initially diagnosed?
I don't remember. I wasn't there. Remember.
So you were in a dissociative state of protecting mm-hmm. yourself due to trauma and the things that you've experienced, and at that point, were you hospitalized?
On more than one occasion.
Yeah. At that time, though, when you received your diagnosis, was it through hospitalization?
No, it was, my wife was getting me in and out of therapy and stuff, and I honestly don't know what my initial diagnosis is. I was never told.
It sounds like you had a pretty lengthy journey as far as from when you started experiencing symptoms of your mental illness through when you were actually diagnosed. How has your life changed since you've received at least your most recent diagnosis that you're aware of what that is?
I'm aware of it as anxiety disorder. It's a self-diagnosis because mm-hmm. there's a lot of things that I become anxious about that I'm comfortable with myself now. I've never been more comfortable in my whole life.
Do you feel like those dissociative episodes have decreased for you?
They have completely diminished. I've let it all go, and I've allowed myself to be open to any and all possibilities that could try and manifest into my life.
May I ask if you are still currently receiving mental health treatment for your diagnosis?
No, I'm not. I am a free bird, so to speak.
So you're doing all this on your own?
Oh, I wouldn't say on my own. I believe in God, and I believe that He is my higher power. And so I look to Him for any questions that may pop up into my life. I always ask Him first.
Have your relationships with your family and friends changed through your journey with your mental illness and mental health?
I've lost everybody, almost everybody in my life, because of my acceptance of what I have been through and my acceptance of what I want to be.
And so I know this is a huge question, but what are your hopes and dreams for the future, for you, from where you're sitting today?
I want to be able to maintain a job like a normal person. Because I feel like I'm a normal person. Have a family. Mm-hmm. And a house. And a car. What everybody wants, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Are there any specific supports that you can identify that particularly helped in your mental health journey and recovery?
I turned to meditation somewhere around 10 years ago. I turned to meditation as a coping skill to help with all this that I've been going through. And just in the last 3 years, I've been accepting that as a definite help. And I pushed myself into that meditation state to where my mind has become almost clear, as though I have no thoughts but happiness, and I wake up each morning with an emptiness inside. Not a negative emptiness, I'm just ready for the day to throw whatever it wants at me, because I know I can handle it.
So you feel like your primary treatment now for your anxiety is in fact meditation?
Yeah.
You hear a lot about meditation and mindfulness being, mm-hmm. you know, things that can be particularly helpful with anxiety, but I know that sometimes it's hard to get the...
It's definitely hard.
It's very hard to get that sort of self-discipline to remove everything, so I'm sure it took a lot of practice. Did you have anyone that helped you?
No. I watched a few videos online, and I just talked with people about it more and more, and the more frequent I pushed myself to that extent of mindfulness, I guess, it's become somewhat easy to just move through my day and just be aware of everything and nothing all at the same time.
If there was anything that you wanted people to know about mental illness or what it means to be a person who has experienced mental illness, what would be the most important thing you think people should know?
Keep moving forward. Never give up.
Yeah.
There's always hope.
Keep moving forward, never give up. The words of Michael, one of the members of Southern Oregon Compass House in Medford, speaking to Galen Thoreau, the Compass House Outreach Coordinator. Elizabeth Hazelwood, the Executive Director of Southern Oregon Compass House, back in the studio with me once again. Thanks for joining us here on The Exchange.
Thank you for having us.
And you picked up on it right away. It was the first thing I was going to ask about anyway, but the fact that this is the first time we've had an interview from Compass House talking about dissociation, which means what?
A lot of times, especially when you've had early traumas in your life, your brain kind of protects itself and can sort of pull your consciousness away, like a numbness, to kind of step back from the situation so you don't have to feel it as much. And there's a lot of research being done specifically around trauma and how the brain is essentially trained to disassociate.
We talk a lot about trauma-informed care in today's world. So, how common is it that there is trauma for, well, I guess for the whole population would be one question. The other question is, how often is it a factor with people dealing with mental illness?
It is almost always a factor with people dealing with mental illness. But the ACEs study really has, over the time, proven to be true.
That's
think
the adverse it's, childhood experiences.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that everybody should be aware of because – you know, the reality of it is that we are all faced with some form of childhood trauma, but it is a really good predictor. And it really looks at how trauma can affect your whole body, your whole brain function, how you see things, and really helps you deal with what has happened to you instead of what's wrong with you, and really changes the focus around dealing with trauma.
You are a different person with trauma than you would have been without it, you're saying.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that we are very fortunate to have a trauma-informed behavioral health unit here in the Valley. And they went through a whole certification on the sanctuary model to be able to be trauma-informed and make sure that everyone that is on the behavioral health unit is treated that way and really looked at as what has brought you here today.
All right. So everybody has a trail of things that brought them to a certain place, and that's the way to catch up on what that trail is.
Absolutely. And how to move forward and get past those and get how to deal with trauma in an effective way and move forward.
One of the things that Michael talked about, too, was about displaying different personalities. And the idea of one person having markedly different personalities is such a trope of soap operas and B-movies, but it does happen. I mean, is it rare? Is it a little more common than that?
I probably am not the best person to ask about that. From my understanding, the diagnosis is extremely rare, but we all have different facets to ourselves, and we all have different ways that we respond. And different situations can change how we react. If something reminds us or triggers us to something that has been traumatic in the past, we'll have a reaction based on that, as opposed to maybe how we would typically respond.
That's interesting. So the fact that we do have different facets to our personalities, we've all gotten out of situations where we went, wow, that is not the way I normally act. And so it's just accentuated in some circumstances.
Absolutely.
So Michael talked about not being told what his diagnosis was, at least at first. We've talked many times about him, how important that initial diagnosis is. Any idea why a health professional would keep a diagnosis from a person?
There can be lots of different reasons, but oftentimes it's because sometimes they don't know. People, our clinicians, don't get to spend as much time as they would like, and it takes sometimes a while to get a full picture of a person. And, you know, a lot of our people have said that they've gotten so many diagnoses over the years that the first one was completely incorrect. And so I think sometimes people are trying to wait before giving a diagnosis so that way they make sure that they're giving a correct one.
I think that answers my next question. Do mental health pros disagree upon diagnoses? And the answer is an emphatic yes. And
absolutely.
So how is that remedied for the client's benefit?
I think that that is an area of growth that we definitely need to work on as a society. That, you know, if one person goes to one clinician and then sees another, they shouldn't get entirely different diagnosis, different medicines, because that's really challenging, especially if their clinician changes and their new one comes in and wants to change everything up. That can be really hard.
Elizabeth Hazelwood, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange in this month's edition of Compass Radio. She is the director of Southern Oregon Compass House in Medford. We have talked about the difficulty in even knowing a diagnosis to get the right medication, but we've not asked about the mix of medication and other therapies, talk therapy, for example. And in Michael's case, he brings up meditation as well. I mean, is it does everybody usually have at least some talk therapy in addition to medication?
It's completely individualized, but that's how it typically works best. And as far as meditation goes, it's so effective. We actually do it in our program daily in a non-clinical environment. But it's one of those things that can really help recenter you and focus you, especially with people that are living with anxiety, myself included. It can really be a way to kind of help get control over all of those thoughts that are going a million miles in your brain and give you power back.
I'm glad you brought up non-clinical environment. This is something we underscore with Southern Oregon Compass House. It's not a place where people go for their actual mental health services. But there are some things you do together, from the sounds of it, where people can feel like they're part of a group, do some things to help make their day better that doesn't amount to therapy.
Absolutely. This is a place where we always describe it as, if you think of everything mental health centers do, all the incredibly important clinical things, we don't do any of that. What we do is everything else. So employment, education, housing, social skills, life skills, and most importantly, a place to be wanted and needed for you.
Compass House has existed how long in Medford?
5 years.
Okay, so you have been in existence entirely within the Obamacare period, is that right?
Yes.
And how big a difference has Obamacare and Medicaid expansion made to mental health services?
I think a great deal. I was not here in Oregon before that, but I was in Tennessee, and that also had an expanded Medicaid program. And before that, I was in Florida, and there's definitely a huge difference in the states that have the expanded Medicaid services.
Are there enough providers?
Okay.
You answered that one very quickly.
Yes, there's simply not. And this is not just an Oregon problem, but there's a lot of great research about how limited we are in providers here, especially in the rural areas.
What else is needed, specifically in the region you serve, to help people with persistent mental illness?
Consistency, more providers, finding a way to streamline and get people in quicker. And there's a lot of work being done on these things by a lot of really great people, but we still have a ways to go.
Well, we always appreciate the window we get into the experience of people who deal with mental illness. It is persistent mental illness for the people at Southern Oregon Compass House, which is built on a clubhouse model. That is where Elizabeth Hazelwood is the executive director. We also heard from Michael this month with the help of an interview with Galen Thoreau, the outreach coordinator at Southern Oregon Compass House. Elizabeth, thank you again, and thanks to all the people at Compass House for making Compass Radio possible.
Thank you.